Well, it's great to be here. I've been here a week. It's been a lot of fun. And what I'm going to talk about is probably a bit different from what you heard so far, at least in the few talks that I've seen. I'm trying to talk about boundary layers, in particular bottom boundary layers of the ocean, but the emphasis will be less on the specific of the boundary layers, even though I discuss a bit what bottom boundary layers are, and more on their impact on the abyssal circulation, because I'll try to make a case that these abyssal boundaries are controlling the abyssal circulation to a degree that has not been appreciated. Bear with me and decide whether you agree with it or not. Since we're close to Hollywood, I also decided to put the Sphinx of the Abyss. And I didn't realize that it was so appropriate, because here it says, a place on Earth more awesome than anything in space, so we can compete with dark matter, according to Hollywood. But the talk will definitely share a lot of aspects with probably dark matter physics, in the sense that the abyssal ocean is the part of the ocean is less sampled, so the observational constraints are much weaker than anything that you might discuss for the upper part of the ocean. And that's why some of these ideas might be relevant, just because the problem hasn't been studied as much because of lack of direct information. So first of all, I just want to set the stage of what is the question. There are mostly oceanographers, probably for the oceanographer this is all very clear, but there are some meteorologists that deserve some attention too. So I want just to say what is the big picture one is trying to address when you're talking about the abyssal ocean. And I think there are two questions that a theory should be able to address. The first one is that the ocean is deeply stratified. So here I'm showing you a section from the Pacific Ocean, is P15. It's going all the way from Antarctica to the Northern Hemisphere to Bering Strait. And this is depth. And in color, you see density surfaces. And the point is that water are lighter at the surface and becomes denser. If you progress downward, the ocean is always stably stratified in that sense. If you compute N over F, is always larger than around 10 or so all the way to the abyss. It's much larger than that, close to the surface. It's much more stratified here, but it remains stratified to the ocean bottom. This is something that we probably all agree. I didn't realize that it was until Robert Boyle, the chemist, in the end of the 1700s, that it was realized that the ocean should be stably stratified. Before then, it was agreed by the scientific community, since there was geothermal heating coming from the ocean bottom, probably the bottom of the ocean should be lighter than the ocean at the surface, and the idea was that water was a very conductive fluid and could sustain a stable stratification. So any theory that you want to have of the abyssal ocean must account for why this ocean is stably stratified. The second element that is agreed upon, and I'm really putting these two elements because I think there is no dispute on both of these elements, and there are a lot of others where you might have discussions, is that we also have a bit of an idea what is the zonally average circulation of this ocean. So this is now a zonal average global. This is depth, again, from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere. And I'm showing streamlines of the zonally average circulation, mostly to make the point that if you take a zonal average now, it's across all global oceans. This is an estimate made by Lumpkin and Spear in 2007 from hydrographic section, so it's our best direct estimate from observation, mostly from the WOAS era in the 90s, where a lot of sections were collected across all global oceans. What you see is that there are two cells, one in that starts in the southern hemisphere with water sinking all the way to the ocean bottom and then folding back and coming to the surface. And a second cell that instead starts, well, in the northern hemisphere, it's really in the North Atlantic, if you look basin by basin, water sinks down and comes back all the way to the surface. It turns out that this upper cell, as it travels the global ocean, doesn't change its density all that much. So that circulation is essentially a long density surface. But this second circulation clearly sinks all the way in the ocean abyss and comes back again in the southern ocean. This water, by the time it comes back, must be much lighter than the water that enters into the ocean because it crossed density surface. I insisted that there is stable stratification all the way through here, so the water must have changed its density. These conversions are largest below 2,000 meters. This is this dashed line that I put here, and this gray line that you see there is an estimate of the typical height of ridges and seamounts in the global ocean. So wherever there is strong topographic features, you see the waters can cross density surface. Now, any theory of the abyssal circulation, therefore, has to account for these two aspects. The ocean is stably stratified and circulation can cross density surfaces. Again, if you are an atmospheric scientist, this would not be particularly surprising to say something like the Hadley cell, of course, crosses isentropes. The difference is that the atmosphere is transparent to electromagnetic radiation, so there are conversion processes that can change the property of air masses as they move in the vertical The ocean instead is opaque to electromagnetic radiation. That means there is nothing penetrating as deep as 2,000 meters. So it's not that trivial to understand how this water can change their own property. There isn't just anything warming directly these water masses through radiation from space. So it is part of the dynamics that has to be solved for.
Can you say how these observations are made? I mean, are people really measuring very weak vertical velocities? And
you don't measure the vertical velocity, and you don't need to because you measure the horizontal velocity, right? You can measure horizontal velocity in different places. They use different hydrographic section. Then if you're taking a zonal average, you have a string function that we can reconstruct just by integrating V, and this is the vertical velocity comes out of that. This is one estimate directly from hydrographic section. There are some more elaborate ones that use a combination of models and hydrographic section, or just model estimates. While the strength of this circulation is something one could argue with, there is no question such a circulation exists and it does cross density surfaces. I think you wouldn't find any oceanographer claiming that there is no abyssal circulation, but how strong it is, yes, there would be discussions. So now I just want to review very quickly, and this is really trying to get everybody up to speed more than a serious review, but it's what has been called the classical recipe, and I call it recipe because Walter Monk, who turned 100 this year, is one of the grandfathers of physical oceanography, in 66 published a paper that has been very influential on these topics called abyssal recipes. So what is the classical recipe? Our classical understanding of how that circulation and that stratification are maintained is based on essentially two elements. The first one is really talking about how the stratification and the circulation coexist. And Walter Monk posited that in these abyssal recipes, that a leading order, if I think about these water masses in the ocean abyss, I might think that there is a balance between the vertical advection of waters. You remember that this is the waters that are moving through density surface in the vertical up here. So this water is coming up across density stratification. So there must be vertical advection across the vertical stratification. This is the advection term. And this must be balanced by vertical diffusion of heat from above. And what this is really is again, it's a buoyancy flux. He was just saying that there must be some turbulence that is mixing warm water from above towards the ocean abyss. If you believe that there is this leading order balance, well, the first result that Walter Monk was pointing out is that we know that stratification is increasing towards the ocean surface. We know why. Most of the heat is coming through the ocean surface. So if the stratification is increasing, dBdz is my stratification, is the vertical gradient of density. If this is increasing towards the ocean surface, this term is positive. That tells me that W times Bz has to be positive. Since the stratification is always positive because the ocean is stably stratified, this means that W is positive. So the argument was if there is some turbulence that diffuses heat downward, that must be balanced by a net rising of water masses, and that explains why these waters can rise through density surfaces. Walter Monk went also a bit beyond that, knowing a bit, at least the order of magnitude of the vertical circulation, or that overturning that was estimated. He inferred how strong of a turbulent diffusivity he needed to close this budget, because he had information about the stratification, some information of the order of magnitude W, so he could infer kappa T. And he got a number close to 10 to the minus 4 meters squared per second for that diffusivity. That is at least three orders of magnitude larger than thermal diffusivity, the molecular diffusivity of heat. So he was making the point, this must be a turbulent diffusivity, some turbulent process that generates that mixing. And the argument at that point was that it's gravity wave breaking. You have gravity waves in the ocean interior. They occasionally break by Kelvin-Helmholtz-like instabilities. And that essentially is like a spoon mixing heat from the surface toward the interior. But it's a large number, so it has to be a turbulent process. Just so that you keep in mind for where we're going to go, is that the kappa T here was assumed to be a constant, that there was some turbulent uniform diffusivity across the global ocean, given that he had no measurement at the time of what might be happening in the ocean abyss. That was the only assumption he could make. Any variability would have been out of the hat. So it was a useful starting point, but we'll see to what extent that might hold. The second piece of the story that actually appeared before the paper by Walter Monk, but to be fair, Walter Monk is the one that grounded it a bit more in observations. But the other fundamental and key contribution was by Stommel and Arons. They pointed out that if there is this upwelling of waters through this density stratification, that tells you also that there must be a horizontal circulation associated with that. And what Stommel and Arons posited again is that you can write a potential vorticity budget, and they said that the meridional advection of potential vorticity has to be balanced by the vortex traction of planetary vorticity. And now, if you assume, and this is going to be another important assumption, if you assume that the ocean bottom is flat, so W is equal to zero, the ocean bottom is your boundary condition, and W is positive everywhere above it, this term has to be positive. And so their conclusion was that you must have a beta V that is positive, this term is positive, that means that you must have polar flow everywhere in the ocean, at least in the ocean interior, in the abyss, in response to this stretching. You have waters, and let me show, don't read the rest of the slide, but this is a good schematic for what they were describing. These arrows are showing the vortex stretching on water rising that drives this polar flow in the interior. These are all these arrows that are now a meridional flow. And then they made the claim that the circulation has to close somewhere, and it's closed along a western boundary current. This was, again, an important insight because it turns out that all the theory, all the elements of the theory up to this boundary current and close of the circulation could not be tested, but indeed, people identified at the time deep western boundary currents, and that seemed to be in support of this theory, that there was indeed that return flow. The reason why the boundary current is the only thing you can measure is that all this meridional flow is spread over the whole Pacific, but the return flow would be all confined in a western boundary current, so the signal is much stronger, there are stronger velocities. So up to this point, it seems that under this assumption, we had an idea of what maintained that stratification and what is the horizontal circulation that it implies, and we've even seen abyssal boundary currents, so the whole story seemed to hold together to some extent. Now I want to go back and emphasize again that two key assumptions that were made is that the topography of the ocean is flat. We know that that's not the case, but does it matter? And the second one is that it was assumed that the diffusivity is constant. Ever since, we know that diffusivity is not constant, but again, does it matter in a fundamental way, or the picture overall still holds? And indeed, if you take any classical books on physical oceanography, this is still the picture, the overall description of the abyssal circulation you'll find. So the first issue of the flat bottom is something that it's quite interesting. It was pointed out early on, well, maybe not that early because it's in the 90s, 20 years after the work of Stommel, but mostly Peter Rhines, and there is a paper also by Trevor McDougall that hints at a bit the same issue. They were pointing out, if you start thinking about the ocean not as this flat bottom ocean, but an ocean that has sloping lateral boundary, it's not clear that the idea of Stobel and Aarons carries through as easily. So here they just said, well, this is Peter Rhines' argument. Assume you have a bowl-shaped ocean, so now the area of the ocean is increasing with height. Well, here it was constant with height in the Stommel-Aarons picture. So now, if you assume that there is some dense water that forms a high latitude sinks in the ocean abyss at some rate S naught, well, that water has to rise back to the surface to have a closed mass budget. So you say the W, the vertical velocity times the area of your ocean, has to be equal to S naught at every depth level. This has to be your closed mass budget. We said, but then I can compute my DDZ of W just by using this expression because I know that W is S naught over A, so I can take the DDZ of S naught over A. S naught is a constant because it's the amount of water that sinks all the way to the deep oceans. It's only the area that changes. So you find that DDZ of W must be equal to minus S naught DDZ of A over A squared. Right? Just taking the derivative. Now, the area of the ocean, because it's bowl shaped, is increasing towards the surface. Right? It's getting larger and larger. So DDZ of W has to be negative, and you understand where that comes from. Now you're saying that there is a lot of water that comes from the abyss, but since the area is growing up, the rate at which your upwell starts slowing down progressively just because the area is getting larger. But now if DDZ of W is negative, when I go back to the budget that Stommel and Aarons were talking about, I had the beta V is equal not to a positive number, as was positive for the flat bottom ocean, it's actually equal to a negative number. So that would imply all of a sudden that you reverse the circulation. Instead of having this cyclonic circulation with polar flow, you now have an anticyclonic circulation with equatorial flow. And here Peter Rhines, actually this is a paper that I recommend to read, well, as all of Peter Rhines' papers, I'm recommending to read this particular section. There are plenty of other sections, some more interesting than others, but this one is very, very interesting. And he's not even making the point that this is the solution. He was just suggesting that the fact that the ocean boundary might be sloping seems potentially of serious importance and was ignored at that point. And so we revisit that aspect. But there is a second aspect that instead appeared more recently. Now it's starting from the 90s. It took a long time for the oceanographic community from the observational side to develop probes that could measure turbulent mixing all the way down to the ocean bottom, or essentially your kappa T. It's very difficult because you're asking to measure turbulence on a scale of a few centimeters with a probe that has to go essentially 4,000 meters below the ship. So any small perturbation or fluctuation could affect the turbulent measurement. So they had to design very sensitive instrument that fell at a very constant rate so that they didn't generate extra turbulence. It took essentially another 30 years since the work of Stommel, or 20 years since the work of Walter Munk before such instrument appeared. They're called now high resolution profilers, but now we can measure profiles of vertical mixing through the whole water column. And when you do that, you get pictures of this kind. This is now a plot of the buoyancy flux itself, or technically of the dissipation of kinetic energy, you should say. Right? And this is in particular from an experiment in the Southern Ocean, DIMES I was involved in, but there have been a number before. But the picture is always quite consistently of this form. So this is now depth above the ocean bottom. And what you see is that dissipation of kinetic energy increases by two orders of magnitude in watts per kilogram as you approach the ocean bottom. So it becomes much larger in the bottom 500 meters of the ocean, maybe the bottom 1,000 meters of the ocean. So it increases towards the ocean bottom. It's not just in the boundary layer at this point, because your boundary layer is not 1,000 meters deep, but it is definitely bottom intensifying. So if you go back to the argument that Walter Munk was talking about, the gamma z, that there is an imbalance between advection and the divergence of the diffusive flux. Now, what has been measured here is really kappa TBZ. It generally posited to be equal to a gamma epsilon. Epsilon is dissipation of kinetic energy. Some fraction of that energy ends up in raising the geopotential of the fluid. So this value is order of 20% or so. You might multiply by epsilon. So this is the estimate of epsilon, which was directly measured. Right? So if this term clearly is decreasing from the bottom up, this is negative, that implies that W has to be negative. It's forcing a sinking of velocity, a sinking of waters, not a rising of waters, because of the vertical profile of kappa. There are people probably here. Is there anybody that is a keen follower of the literature on mixing efficiency? Because I don't know if I want to go online for saying that, but I think it's important that that literature...
Turn off the mic.
I'll be happy to do that.
I think something will implode if we do. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That makes it more fun. I don't know how to do it. That's the point.
The camera keeps going.
The camera keeps going. And I think
that's even better.
As well.
Yeah. But I think that it's important that what that literature has forgotten in that discussion, and it's important to keep in mind, is that the range of variation of epsilon is two orders of magnitude. When you look at that literature, at least in stratified waters, if you go in completely unstratified water, it's a different story, but it's not even clear why you would talk about mixing efficiency, because if you mixed water, you're not going to do much. But as long as there is substantial stratification, nobody's talking about gamma really dropping by two orders of magnitude. So the basic pattern is set by variation of epsilon, so it's not set by variation in gamma. So this argument is really telling us that it looks like we're abetting water downward, unlike what Walter Munk was talking about. And let maybe first revisit that same statement so that everybody follows what is happening. As I said, the measurements really measure kappa T times BZ, because they measure the full buoyancy flux. But we could rewrite the budget the way Walter Munk wrote it, as the DBZ of kappa T BZ. Now what I'm saying is that when you take that vertical derivative, you really have two terms. One is the vertical derivative of kappa times B, and then there is kappa T times the second derivative of BZ. Walter Munk, at leading order, assumed that this term was second order, and because he didn't know much about what those vertical variations would be, so he couldn't really do much more than that. And indeed, we said that this term is positive, because the stratification increases towards the ocean top, and so this would give you a positive contribution. But what we're finding out is that indeed this is, again, the profile of epsilon, but I can also plot the profile of kappa itself. Kappa is just epsilon over the stratification. It turns out that this term is decreasing from the ocean bottom, and it is so fastly decreasing, or at least the evidence is decreasing much faster than this one is increasing, so in the net you get a negative term. Right? So it's suggesting that waters are indeed sinking in response to mixing, and we have it already here. we can try to explain a bit why that is happening in an even more intuitive way. But you start understanding both the flat bottom assumption and the idea that this mixing is driving upwelling of water seem to be inconsistent with the observational literature that has appeared ever since. The argument I can review again, why is it that water are sinking in response to this mixing? Well, think that you are a water parcel sitting above the bottom of the ocean. This is your bottom topography. This is a water parcel that might be 1,000 meters above the bottom of the ocean, so not in a boundary layer per se. We said that this water, the mixing is increasing, or the cup is increasing as you move deeper into the water column. So this water parcel is mixed more with water below it, which are denser, than with water above it, which are lighter. So in response to mixing, this water parcel, because of the profile of mixing, is getting denser. And if it's getting denser, it will start sinking down towards the ocean topography. And that's the argument. I mean, there isn't anything particularly suspicious. So it's just that the evidence that this profile of cup is increasing to the ocean bottom would imply sinking of waters. There's been a lot of literature since this first observation have appeared that suggests that there isn't anything magical about mixing increasing towards the ocean bottom. It's that the ocean bottom is very good at radiating gravity waves, because you have either tidal flows or mean flows rubbing over bottom topography, much like in the atmosphere when you're flying over the Rockies. So you create all these internal gravity waves, and some fraction will tend to break some distance from the topography. So that's the generation of turbulence. So you have higher turbulence closer to where you generate it, and less as you move away from it. So now, we said that there was water sinking at high latitudes. That was the picture of the overturning, with water sinking all the way to the ocean at these high latitudes. And there was Walter Monk arguing that mixing is bringing the water back to the surface in the ocean interior. Now, the problem is that it seems that now mixing, it's also driving water towards the bottom topography. So this water somehow has to come back up if I want to have a steady state ocean that doesn't keep filling up. And indeed, you can think about a water now sitting on a boundary layer, so very close to the bottom topography. Just for discussion purposes, assume really a water parcel is sitting on the bottom topography. Well, that water cannot be mixed with water below it, because there is no water below it, there is just topography. It can only be mixed with water above it, so this water will only be mixed with lighter waters. And as it gets lighter now, it can slide along the bottom topography towards the surface, right? So indeed, it looks like water can sink toward bottom topography, but then in response to that mixing with what is above it, they can slide back to the surface as long as the topography is inclined. If the topography was flat, they wouldn't be able to come back to the surface. So Baylor didn't give me the 3 hours I asked, so I'm not going to go through an exercise of actually showing a numerical solution that you could do of these kind of problems, where you have a vertical mixing that increasing towards the ocean bottom with large-scale models, and see what happens. Instead, what I decided I'll do is now two exercises. The first one is trying to see that, okay, I designed this picture with some water sinking towards the ocean bottom. Does it matter in the big scheme of things for the global ocean? So we'll try to do some very hand-wavy scaling estimate for the global ocean to see what the circulation driven by mixing increasing toward the ocean bottom and the topography not being flat will do for the global ocean. And then we'll try to develop, based on those results, a theory that tries to close that circulation. So the circulation in an ocean that has mixing increasing towards the ocean bottom and it has sloping topography.
So Ralph, just in your previous slide, I didn't catch how you could use the same vertical variation of thermal diffusivity and change the sign of the from sinking to upwelling.
So this one, and yeah, we'll actually get to solutions, people that like numerical solution, you'll actually see how that happens. But even more simply, it's just that this water mass is sitting over the ocean bottom. In the ocean, lateral gradients are much weaker than vertical gradients. It's only the vertical mixing really that matters. So this water parcel is not being mixed with anything below it, because there is a non-normal flux boundary condition. But it's still mixed with water above it, which is a bit lighter. So in response to mixing, this water now is becoming lighter. Now, how can it rise? Well, it could go up a bit, but then as soon as you move away from the topography, it gets pushed back in. So it's essentially jumping up the topography in some sense, right? It can slide up the topography because there it's being warm. For a meteorologist, I think the best way to think about it is that this is really equivalent to radiative cooling in terms of the profile and what is happening. And this is your radiative heating right at the boundary, so you can slide over the topography. It's just in the ocean that radiative heating is really confined to the topography wherever there is topography, so that's the only place where you can rise. It is really the same problem as radiative heating. It's just that the profile of heating and cooling is set by turbulent mixing,
yes.
Not set by radiative processes, but eventually just the profile. It's a bit more clear.
Yeah, definitely.
So if I want to figure out what is happening in the real ocean, as I said, I could try to, what I want to try to do is to come up with some simple estimate of how much upwelling is happening into this bottom boundary layer. BBL is for bottom boundary layer along the ocean topography, and how much sinking is happening in the stratified mixing layer. That's what I call the layer above the bottom boundary layer where mixing is strong, but it's increasing downward, so it's driving sinking. And this, if I want to estimate for the global ocean what that term is, I have to integrate over the stratified mixing layer the amount of vertical velocity. Technically speaking, really the diapicnal velocity, but for practical purposes, it doesn't make a difference, right? And now it's back to the same budget I had before. I was saying E times the stratification, W times the stratification is given by the diversion of the buoyancy flux. So if I want to know the integral of E, so this is now, again, the same picture I had before. This is my bottom topography. This, for example, is my bottom boundary layer. If I want to know how much water is rising upward through this bottom boundary layer, well, I have to integrate the divergence of my turbulent buoyancy flux, or if you want the kappa TBZ, but this is what it really is the velocity perturbation correlated with buoyancy perturbation due to mixing events, divided by the stratification. If I had both of these numbers for the global ocean, well, I can then estimate how much upwelling there is in the net integrating overall bottom boundary layer. I can do the same thing. It's exactly the same calculation above, for what I call the stratified mixing layer. Again, if I know the DDZ or the buoyancy profile or the turbulent buoyancy flux, I can estimate how much water is sinking through that layer. And again, here now it's my buoyancy flux, and you see that it's increasing towards the ocean bottom. It's negative, the buoyancy flux itself, and then it goes to zero in a bottom boundary layer. So just to be all on the same board, if I want to do this exercise, what am I really trying to estimate for the global ocean? What I need to know is how much mixing is generated by gravity waves, and this is just a Kelvin Helmholtz instability movie, but you have dense water over light water. There was a wave that was passing by. It goes unstable, and it starts mixing the fluid. So the two elements that you need to know something about to do that kind of calculation is how much the rate of generation of waves that are supporting the mixing and what fraction of those waves ends up through instability of this kind that increase the mixing of the water column. And this part of the talk is the most hand-wavy, then we start becoming more and more quantitative as we move away from this. But just to give you a bit of a feeling, I can estimate the first part actually I can do reasonably well. If I want to know the rate at which I generate waves in the ocean abyss, the two main motions in the ocean, in the bottom of the ocean, that generate waves are barotropic tides that slosh back and forth over the topography, and mean geostrophic motion is mostly geostrophic eddies that you heard a number of times people, oceanographers, talking about. This is where most of the eddy kinetic energy of the ocean is. If I want to do the tidal problem, therefore, I just need a barotropic tidal model that gives me what is the bottom velocity of the ocean. There are barotropic tidal models that have pretty good skill in reproducing and distribution of barotropic tides. I need to know the bottom stratification in the ocean, what is the BZ close to the ocean bottom, because that sets the rate of generation of waves. And I need to know the bathymetry, actually the large-scale bathymetry. Most of the tides that you generate, the internal waves that you generate for barotropic tides are pretty low mode, so we can just look at the low mode bathymetry. If I have these three pieces of observation, then I can just use linear theory for internal tides and just look what is the rate of generation of tides. There are a number of papers from, we used a particular version by Nykander, but Bill Young or Chris Garrett, a number of people, Lucien Laurent, has worked on this problem. So you can just estimate, and this is a map of the rate of generation of internal tides. So I think it's in terawatts per meter. So you see that big ridges is where you generate most of these internal waves. You can do the same thing for the eddy motions. Also, the eddy motion are going to generate internal waves. Again, in that case, we're going to use a numerical model to get an estimate of bottom velocity in the ocean because we don't have direct observations for that. The model was validated against some mooring data where you had mooring data, but mooring data at the ocean bottom are still pretty limited. Then again, we need the bottom stratification. In this case, most of the waves you can, this is just linear wave theory. Since you can generate waves only between frequency and F and N, if you have a mean motion, your most of the generation is due to topographic scales that are pretty small, of order of a kilometer or so. So we couldn't use large-scale bathymetric maps. Instead, we use ship soundings, and we look at the statistics of these small hills that generate the waves. But if you have some information about the statistics of these waves that you have from ship sounding, then you can also do, again, with linear theory, you can estimate how much waves you generate in the global ocean. So now I'm going to have two maps, the generation of waves by tides and by geostrophic motions. It's mostly the tides dominate the radiation, but as you see, they don't radiate much in the Southern Ocean, so you really need to compute also the second component, because geostrophic eddies are particularly strong in the Southern Ocean. They dominate the generation there. I'm going very fast, so I apologize, but I can't do this all detail. You should just wait for the next slide to try to give you a bit the feeling of what comes out of this. And this is indeed hand-waving. It's just to give you a bit of a flavor of why what we're discussing matters. Clearly, it's not quantitatively correct, or quantitatively reliable. In the sense, what I discuss right now is how do we estimate the rate at which energy is radiated, either from tides or through geostrophic motion in internal waves. So this is how much waves I generate. And now I have to estimate, once I know how much waves I generate from the ocean bottom, what fraction of it ends up going unstable and generating mixing. And here in this particular version, I'm trying to keep it extremely simple. So I say that observations suggest that when you look locally, the rate of energy that is locally dissipated from generation of internal tides or lee wave generated by geostrophic motion is anywhere between 10 and 50%. Depending on the character of the topography, we're going to assume it's 30%, just to keep it simple. So we say that Q, 30% of that energy gets dissipated locally, and it tends to be dissipated locally closer to the bottom topography and less away from the topography. So we multiply this expression by a vertical function, an integral of one, that tells you that most of the dissipation happened within 500 meters of the ocean. There is an e-folding scale. This is essentially an exponential with an e-folding scale of order 500 meters. So most of the dissipation is about 500 meters. Most of it is within 1,000 meters of the ocean bottom. So now we have an estimate of how much energy is being dissipated, kinetic energy is being dissipated by this wave breaking. And then this is the expression of Osborne that tells us if we know the energy dissipation, and we multiply again by some mixing efficiency, we can get the buoyancy flux. Because we said that once a wave breaks, when you see this breaking event and all the kinetic energy that gets dissipated in Joule heating, some fraction of it goes into mixing the fluid and raising the geopotential. That is a buoyancy flux. So now I can have an estimate for what is W prime D prime that has a full vertical structure at every place in the ocean, because I can do this calculation at every point in the ocean. And now I can use the calculation to estimate the rate of water that is being upwelled. You remember that the only thing I really need in the calculation was the DDZ of W prime B prime, and now I have some hand-wavy way of estimating the W prime B prime. So again, before we get to discussion of that result, I'm plotting again the overturning circulation. This is latitude from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. And this is, again, the two cells of the overturning circulation, water sinking high latitudes and coming back, and water sinking a high latitude in the northern hemisphere and coming back. Now, this is plotted instead of depth, as the first plot I've shown you is plotting a neutral density or density surfaces. So it is the conserved quantity, if you want, is isentrop of the ocean. The black curve here is now telling me, according to the calculation I've done, my estimate of DDZ of W prime B prime, I can calculate the net amount of water that is being upwelled when I integrate over everything, meaning boundary layers and the interior. And you see that if you look up to a density surface 28.1, which is this density surface here, so it's close to the maximum of this abyssal circulation, which is what I'm focusing on. I said the one above, you see that doesn't change density all that much. So I'm more interested in the one below. And you get an estimate that the amount of water that is being upwelled through this process is of order of 10 Sverdrup. Sverdrup is 10 to the 6 meter cubed per second. And if you look at the maximum here, we are a bit above the maximum. It's of order of 10 Sverdrup. So it tells me that this calculation, at least at the order of magnitude level, is consistent with a direct estimate of the overturning. So I'm at least getting that flavor of the calculation correct. Now, the reason I wanted to do it point by point is that now I can do separate the calculation of my upwelling in the boundary layers and in the waters above, because I claim that the waters above, I'll find that there is a lot of sinking. And in the boundary layer, I find a lot of upwelling. And indeed, I can do this calculation. Now, this is the red line. So I can look at how much water is crossing this density surface, 28.1, upward in a boundary layer, and I find that there is 40 Sverdrups of water that are moving upward along boundary layers. But now if I do the calculation only on the water sinking just above the boundary layers in the stratified interior, I find there are 30 Sverdrups of water sinking down. So now that is telling me that while it's true that this is a zonally average picture that correctly depicts the zonally average overturning circulation, this circulation is a very small residual of essentially there is 10 Sverdrup of water sinking at high latitudes, plus another 30 Sverdrup of water sinking in response of mixing increasing toward the bottom topography. All these waters move towards the ocean boundary layer, and then you have this 40 Sverdrup of water that bring all the water back to the surface. Right, so in a sense, it's true that 40 minus 30 is 10, but 40 and 30 are much larger number than 10, so just forgetting about that difference seems to miss a big important part of the story. There is a lot happening in these boundary layers that we are generally not addressing. It's implicit in this picture, but it's averaged out.
Ralph?
Yeah?
To get that, in your choice of FZ, that function,
yeah,
you need to have that bottom part.
So how the bottom part is...
Does it matter to have that? Obviously it matters, right? To have that.
Oh, absolutely. So, but what matters is not how thick that is, which would be a big issue because you don't really know how to estimate the bottom boundary layers. We can get to a discussion of exactly what sets their depth for this calculation. But what really matters is you need to know what is this maximum value, which instead set by wherever there is stratified fluid. In that calculation, what matters most is more what is the e-folding scale. Right, so I chose an e-folding scale of 500 meters. If you choose a smaller number, you get even more upwelling along the boundaries. If you spread it out a bit more, the gradients are weaker, you get a bit less. The qualitative picture doesn't change, but quantitatively you can make this number being the difference. Instead of being 10 Sverdrup, you can make it 15 Sverdrup, 5 Sverdrup. And we try to pick that particular number so that it's not too far from the global net.
And when people put that implementation, that parameterization in model.
Yeah.
So effectively, this part is included in the implementation because they set the flux to zero.
Absolutely.
Which means that they set, so that mechanism happens, what you just said, does happen in those climate models.
If you put a cap at it that was varying that strongly, which is never done as far as I can tell. Now people started talking about possibly doing it, but it's not really done.
Okay.
I mean, mostly, the typical case in ocean models would be to have weak mixing in the abyss, then you have a transition, you have high mixing below it, but you don't create that gradient. If you don't create the gradient in mixing, you're not driving subduction, right? So that's more the part that you're generally not getting, because if your kappa T becomes large and uniform in the abyss, your kappa T times BZZ is still positive, so you're still driving upwelling, right? It's really that you need to have a DDZ or kappa T that is increasing very fast towards the topography if you want to get that circulation. But you're absolutely right in terms of having no flux boundary condition. Most ocean models deal with their numerics decently enough that they can at least not warm spuriously the ocean abyss. But I think the point here was to be dubbed that this kind of calculation, again, I keep insisting, they are not to be taken quantitatively at face value, but qualitatively is really telling you that there is this big cancellation and that you can't remove by any choice of those parameters. There is much more water rising along boundaries and sinking in the interior than their difference, which is what balances the high latitude mixing. So this is what I really want to build up to and talk about is, can we actually come back and try to look a bit at what is the dynamics? How does that circulation get set up and how does that upwelling along boundaries layers really come about? So we want to find a way to solve for the overall circulation that develops in response to this sloping boundary and a profile of kappa that increases towards the ocean bottom. And we are inspired by Henry Stallman, so we decided to start very simple and see how far we could get if we used a reduced model of this kind. So in this model, we are assuming very small Rossby numbers, so the Coriolis acceleration is balanced by pressure gradient forces, buoyancy forces, and we put some Rayleigh friction. So we don't have inertia in the momentum equation. We're going to look at the development of the large-scale circulation where Rossby numbers are indeed very small, so this is not a terrible approximation. We're using Rayleigh friction instead of some diffusivity with a viscosity, just to keep the problem simple. As you see, we don't think that qualitatively makes a fundamental difference, but there are some aspects that might be impacted by that choice. The model will assume zero divergence of the velocity field, and then we have the full buoyancy equation, when instead we have a diffusivity with a kappa t grad b. This is essentially Walter Monk's argument. Again, the diffusivity kappa t will be chosen to increase towards the bottom, or if you want, decrease from the ocean bottom as a function of height with some e-folding scale of 500 meters. So we have a profile of kappa t that is self-similar as a function of height above the bottom everywhere in this domain. And so this was the first argument that I claim is very important for the dynamics I've shown. And the second one is that the bottom topography is not going to be flat. So we're going to live in a bathtub. This is our ocean model. And you see the topography is increasing along boundaries, sloping over all boundaries. And so it's really a bowl to start with. Being a bowl, so this is the profile of kappa that is increasing exponentially towards the ocean bottom. But being a bowl, we are going to impose that there is no normal flow through the bottom, but that is going to change the direction of the bottom. It's not just vertical. There is going to be no normal flux through the boundary, so the gradient normal to the boundary of the buoyancy has to be zero. By the way, if there are people that like geothermal heat flux, we can come back to the end. It just even reinforces the picture I'm going to say, but again, it's a small quantitative correction, not qualitative. Now, since we want a model only of the abyssal circulation, you can couple it with the circulation above it. You can have a more complex model. We run more complex models. We can add the inertial term. It's just that any one of the addition makes the problem much harder to understand. You see, it's already hard enough as it is. We're trying to make it as simple as we can. So if we want to ignore all the wind-driven circulation above, we're going to impose the buoyancy at our z equals 0 is 0, or it's flat. So we're assuming that we are looking at the circulation below some flat density surfaces, if you remember density stratification. Maybe if I go back all the way to the beginning, you remember you can consider this being our top boundary condition. For the moment, we are not dealing with the southern ocean that is where the sloping isobeacon. So we are just prescribing that B is flat up here. Then we are solving for the circulation below. So the first thing I want to show you, just to get some sense of what this system looks like, is that we can start with our bowl. We prescribe an initial stratification, so at time t equals 0, our stratification is just n squared z, where n squared is a constant, so it's stably stratified everywhere. But this stratification, am I allowed to draw?
Sure. There's a switch if you want to turn the lights, if you feel like it's not.
Thanks. I don't need to spend that much time, but I started with a stratification that was uniform, and you see that it doesn't match the boundary condition at the boundary, because now the density surface is intersecting the boundary, not at right angle, so there is a flux there. So as soon as I do that in the model, what you see in response, so this is just an initial value problem, so there is not externally forced dynamics yet. You see the density surface has to start bending along the boundary to match the boundary condition. But that really implies that I'm diffusing heat into the boundary. This water is getting warmer than it was at the beginning. And as a result, for the system to achieve steady state, you start developing a flow along the boundary that is bringing cold water up. So the advection of cold water balances the diffusion of heat in the interior, which is, again, the same story that I described at the beginning about this water rising along a boundary. Since the kappa is increasing toward the ocean bottom from the same reason, since there is a very strong kappa above it that is increasing toward the bottom surfaces, and if you look carefully, what the density surfaces end up doing is that they are also getting a bit colder right above the boundary layer, and here is where you have some sinking. So we're just getting the solution I described before, now analytically, numerically for this simple model, with upwelling along the boundary and weak downwelling above it. In this particular model, for the moment, there is no externally forced circulation, so these two circulations, the upwelling and downwelling, exactly balance each other, so there is as much water coming up as there is water coming down. We are in a rotating planet, or this model is including rotation, so you also develop an along slope flow, because you have a tilting of isothickness, so you develop a baroclinic flow that has flow coming at you above the bottom topography and coming into the page right along the boundary. So you start developing also a circulation along isobath in this system. But more importantly, you start seeing this upwelling and downwelling. Maybe I should have said now the model is only non-dimensional coordinates, so minus one is the ocean bottom, zero is the surface, and also laterally, this we are looking east-west. I could have looked north-south and you would see the same picture. And it also goes from zero to one in zonal coordinate. But just to show you that this upwelling and downwelling does indeed develop as I describe it, and maybe now Paul will be happy because we can also actually solve for the problem from first principle. The way you do it is that you say, well, I'm going to work in the along slope coordinates. So this is my tilted ocean bottom here. And I'm going to call x the along slope coordinate and z the across slope coordinate. And I'm going to look for solutions that have some background stratification n squared z, that's what I prescribed at the beginning, plus a perturbation, which is what has to develop to satisfy boundary condition, to satisfy the dynamics. Since I had an n squared z, and I'm in a tilted coordinate system, now x prime and z prime are the rotated coordinates. So my background stratification has both an horizontal and a vertical component in the rotating coordinate system. And then I have this perturbation fluctuation. Now I can plug this buoyancy, which has the background plus the perturbation, into full buoyancy budget. And well, this is the equation you get for the buoyancy perturbation. There is no vertical advection in this problem, as in the way I set it up, because I assume that the stratification is uniform in Z, or in this coordinate system is uniform in X prime and Z prime. So there are no variation in the along topography direction. So the UDX has to be zero in this problem. I'm assuming that there is no Y dependence in the problem. I'm just doing the two-dimensional problem. If there is no X dependence, the UDX has to be equal to zero, which means that the WDZ has to be equal to zero by mass conservation. And since W is equal to zero, W now is the normal to the topography. Since W has to be equal to zero, here has to be zero everywhere. So get the simple balance between U prime and square sine theta, which is the velocity along the bottom, and that has to be balanced by diffusion of heat, which include both a diffusion of heat from the top boundary because of that background stratification, plus the correction that has to develop because the stratification now has to match the boundary at normal angle. So then I would just have to integrate this and I can get the full transport. And you find that the full transport along the boundary layer, if you integrate over the boundary layer, is going to be upslope along the boundary and downslope above it, and it's proportional to the magnitude of the turbulent diffusivity and inversely proportional to the tangent of the angle. So the steeper the tangent, the stronger the flow. Sorry, the flatter the angle, the stronger the flow. So you can actually solve for this problem. I don't think that there is anything more insightful than what I described, but just to show that they are pretty simple dynamical systems that have been worked by Phillips and Wunsch for the non-rotating problem, and then Chris Garrett had a number of papers since that describe in more detail the dynamics that you might see developing. Also, Peter Reins have contributed to this circulation. What they never discussed is, again, what we're going to try to do now is how those circulations will couple with the global overturning I was describing before. This was always thought to be an interesting boundary value problem, and not necessarily a problem that impacts the global circulation, while here I try to make the case that the amount of water you transport in this boundary is essentially as large as the full overturning, actually larger. So what I want to do next, what I want to do next is that I just show you a bit the initial value problem so that we get some feeling for what is the dynamics of this boundary layer. But now I want to couple it to a system that has a full overturning. Right now I wouldn't have any overturning, actually, if I let this system keep running. As I said, I have this boundary flow bringing warm water up and cold water down. But then you have this region that has a flat boundary and you still have a large diffusivity. Here there cannot be any meridional flow to support a circulation like that. All that happens is that since you have a non-normal flow boundary condition, you start destroying the stratification, which is not a big surprise. If I give you any bowl of water that is stratified and on, and I do it as an initial value problem, and I give some turbulent diffusivity, the final state is full homogenization of that water mass. Right? So if I just run the system, it won't maintain the stratification. Eventually, it just pins down for an unstratified water. So now, instead, I want to put some forcing that allow a circulation and a steady state to be achieved. But we now have some intuition for this water sliding up and down and why these boundary flows have to develop. And again, we want to keep the problem simple. So what I'm going to do in the real ocean, what you see is what I was pointing out before, is that you have these densities that are nearly flat, but they steepen up very rapidly in the Southern Ocean. This is the southernmost 20 degrees of the ocean or so. This is because winds are particularly strong over the Southern Ocean, and they manage to tilt density surfaces upward. It's also that there is not meridional continents that allow stratification to be set or that balance to occur on a very shallow thermocline. It becomes much deeper. We don't need to go into any of the details, but it's really suggesting that if you actually look how the density stratification is set for this water mass, well, clearly it's because water masses rise towards the surface in the Southern Ocean. This is where most of these properties are being set, and then they are somehow impacted in the rest of the global ocean. That's where the density surface experience surface force. Indeed, if you look at the time scale for adjustment of stratification in the Southern Ocean, it's typically decadal of that order of magnitude, while the adjustment of stratification we see for the rest of the ocean is much longer. It's hundreds to thousands of years. So what we do to keep, again, the problem simple, we're not saying this is the proper dynamics, but what we can do is that in our buoyancy equation that we were solving before in this form for the initial value problem, now we're putting a restore into some prescribed stratification, which is, again, constant, and we are going to prescribe the stratification in the lower part of the domain, and the restoring time scale is going to be order of a tenth of the diffusive time scale. So we're just making a statement that the dynamics that set the stratification here is faster than the adjustment in the interior, so we can just prescribe it externally. And just say that, well, you relax towards that stratification, the full model then will have to accurately deal with the reentrant channel to the south and do that kind of dynamics. But here, for the moment, we want to keep that part of the problem outside the investigation to focus on how the interior adjusts.
And now you're really specializing to the Pacific because you don't have a northern deep water source.
Yeah, as I said, to a large extent is that I insist that that circulation is much less adiabatic, so it's easier to start with the one that is strongly diabatic. It is definitely much less in the sense that there is a strong component that is adiabatic for sure, then there might be some component that could be even of the same order, but no more than that is diabatic. Now I would have to deal with both. Instead, something Pacific like only has a diabatic circulation, so that's the whole problem I had to deal with, at least to start with. You see, it's complicated enough as it is. Once you solve this, then you can start coupling them. I don't know, here there are a lot of numerical people. We can also, maybe it's a good moment, say why don't you run the full GCM? I contend that as of today, there is no GCM that I know of, and that includes the MIT GCM ROMs we looked into. We look in HICOM, we look in GFDR. They can solve any of this circulation because the slopes are too steep and you end up getting spurious representation mixing along the boundaries that you cannot deal with. And sigma coordinates are not the solution to all problems. You still need a lot of resolution. If you have enough resolution, yes, you can do it. And it's going to be interesting to see whether we can improve on that. But so the model we've written, we had to rewrite it in sigma coordinates with increased resolution along the boundary, then you can, but it's quite expensive.
Well, also you had to run it for 4,000 or 6,000 years. I mean, so you can't, even if you could afford the resolution, you can't afford the resolution and the duration.
Yes. So what we're going to look at here now, I have this model which has a restoring in the southern component. So now this is north and south. I'm looking at my bowl. And this is the region where I restore to a prescribed stratification. So you see the stratification is pretty constant. Now the stratification you get here, now the model has achieved a steady state, has to be transported from the southern hemisphere all the way to the north. So now this is the equilibrated solution, but there is also a bottom layer where the ocean gets quite weakly stratified. And actually that is not inconsistent with what you see in the global ocean, where you see these density surfaces are pretty flat up here, but there is a lower layer where they start encroaching into the bottom topography. So now, if we look at what this model has produced, maybe go back here again. The ocean is stratified as a result of the stratification imposed in the south. And if I take a zonal average, so this is depth and latitude, again, this is my overturning circulation. So this model has at least satisfied, this simple idealized model has satisfied the two requirements I set up at the beginning. I want a model or a basic theory that can account for the stable stratification of the global ocean and a stable overturning across its density surface. So that has happened. Even though we know that if I take now a section through here in the northern hemisphere, so you're looking east-west, this is this section here, even though we know that all the upwelling is happening along boundary layers, or at least most of it, you see this red line is positive velocity going up, and if the quality of my computer or the projector was better, you would also see the blue above it with water sinking towards the ocean bottom. So you do indeed get that all the upwelling is along the boundary, but if I take a zonal average, that's all I see. I have this impression that water is coming up. It just doesn't tell me where it's happening.
And would that be true if you had done the Lumpkin Spear style tracer-based diagnostics? Because sure. I mean, the key of those is that it's in salinity temperature space that they can diagnose the transports, not. And so they have this, that part of it is the game that I think is the most interesting link up. So you didn't use other tracers other than buoyancy in this simulation?
Yeah, I don't think it would make any difference. The problem with temperature and salinity would be that it's becoming hard, possibly harder to diagnose the upwelling in the boundary separately, but the overturning is still the overturning. There is no question that's what you would get even looking at TNS. Any tracer does indeed, in a zonally average sense, a leading order follow that circulation.
Right.
The reason why I'm so confident is that we put particles in this system, and then you can see that they accurately describe that profile. So any conserved tracer, if it's not conserved, of course, you can change it, but any conserved tracer would leading order show this picture. But it becomes tricky. I'll anticipate, probably confusing people, but yes, you have to be a bit careful because this is water moving up here and down there, but there is also a lot of flow along density surface that doesn't change water masses, so you can mix properly along a density surface of that. Can confound what happens in the boundary versus the interior, but in terms of the zonal average picture, that you get back to that same picture because now you don't care about whether things are happening in the boundary or not. So TNS might not be the best tracer to see the separation between boundary and interior, but they're perfectly good to get the overturning. So now for this model, I can show what is the water mass transformation as a function of buoyancy. So now I'm doing, for the model, exactly the same picture that I was doing with this bar of the overturning as a function of density or neutral density in the global ocean. Just to show again, the blue line is my net overturning, so there is water coming up and then down. The gradient of psi is giving me the W, so here is rising water and sinking water. So rising water and sinking water is the two branches of the overturning. But again, I can plot what is upwelling along boundary layer, and this is how much is sinking in the interior. Again, these two are much larger than the residual in most of the ocean, except as you come close to the ocean bottom. That will be important. When we are close to the bottom, it seems that the two don't compensate anymore. But again, there is very large compensation up to the point that at the top, it's mostly water coming up and down without any overturning.
So how does that picture change as you change the slope of your face?
Well, qualitatively it doesn't change. Quantitatively I can change it in the sense that the steeper I make it, the less overturning happens. But that cancellation doesn't really change all that much. It's that if you shrink all the values down or up. And we can discuss that. I mean, the analytic assumption tells you that there should be a very large degree of compensation further up regardless. But the magnitude depends on the kappa and the slope. I won't say what is the real question that somebody should ask. We'll see whether somebody will ask it before the end. There is something that is more interesting in changing the slope, potentially. But again, if I look now to try to get a sense of what the overall circulation that I set up in this problem is, again, I'm looking across this section, east-west, in the northern portion of the domain. Water is rising and sinking. Now, I'm also developing a meridional circulation. Now, finally, I have some forcing to the south. That system has to close. And there is a deep western boundary current bringing flow into the system from the southern hemisphere. So this is the dense water that was formed in the southern hemisphere comes north. This is the meridional velocity, so it's coming to me. This is the zonal velocity, so some of this water starts upwelling along the boundary, and another portion flows all the way laterally and start rising along the eastern boundary. So this is water coming from the south and then comes to the boundary and start rising along density surfaces. Then the water comes back, again zonally, towards the eastern boundary, and there is a return western boundary current that brings the water back. So my overturning is this water coming north and coming back south, but all these waters manage to reach lateral boundaries to come back to the surface. Or I draw a schematic, because generally I confuse people more than anything when I show the full picture, but this is essentially what is happening. You have water coming from the southern hemisphere to the north in a western boundary current. Then these waters move along a western boundary, move along the slope towards lighter density surface, or they reach all the way to the eastern boundary and move up density surface, then they come back down, and they all reach a return western boundary current. So your overturning is this water coming up in dense and back light, but all this transformation has happened along boundary flows.
And the meridional velocity there has a normal style bottom boundary layer momentum balance.
This, because we've written it, yes, it's just a Stommel boundary layer, because we are using a Rayleigh friction.
On the west side.
And this is why they're all stuck. Yes, I should have said they're all on the west side, because they are just on the western boundary layer, and they're much thicker than the boundary layer I'm talking about here.
Right, and they can't sit on top of each other for almost the same reason. They both need to touch the bottom and velocity field so that they have the right vorticity balance.
The fact that you use Rayleigh friction, whether they need to touch the bottom is not necessary, because we have it everywhere, and that's where it might become fishy. But I don't think the fact that they have to sit on top of each other is that if you have an overturning, you really need dense water coming in and lighter water coming out. It's more a thermodynamical constraint. It cannot be at the same value, otherwise it would have no circulation. So if I have a forcing in the southern hemisphere that keeps sorting those waters, so what happens is that this one sits on top, close to the boundary, in a sense. And so you have that overturning in the net.
I'm having trouble closing the circulation in that diagram. So implicitly there's a vertical.
So this is, I didn't draw the second part probably.
It's just the arrows coming.
For you
there's
to
a
see.
Meridional overturning and a zonal overturning.
Yeah. There are two of them, right? So now this was east-west, but there is also a south-north.
Yeah.
Here is my equator. So I have waters that, this is the region where I have my restoring that allows water to be transformed into denser water. Now there is a western boundary current moving north, then waters keeps going through all the way to the northern hemisphere. And then this water rise along boundaries and come back a bit lighter above it. So this should come back here. Right. So this is my overturning that I was describing before in density space. But here I'm trying to plot the east-west component and show that all that transformation that in this picture you might think it's just happening uniformly through the interior. It's not really happening this way. It's all happening with water sliding along boundaries and coming back. So the solution is strongly constrained by what happens in the bottom boundary layer. I think I'm done. I think that this in itself is not worth spending too much time on, except that it's telling you something quite fundamental in terms of the importance of the boundary layers for the full solution. Because what I'm doing here is now that I can write an analytical solution for the solution along my boundary flows. And if you remember in the picture I've shown here, you see that there's a big overshoot. This water is true that it enters here and comes back there, but it rises up and down. So these two branches of the flow essentially are the same and they cancel out. It's only down here that some water that comes here comes out there. So the boundary flow here is strong, but there is nothing to compensate above. But here, these two are essentially the same magnitude. Water just gets flushed back and forth. I have an analytical solution for what is the flow in the two branches. So I can compute how much water is coming up here, down there, if I know the stratification and the slope. Now, the stratification is essentially the stratification I impose in the Southern Ocean. So I can assume I know it because I can use that stratification I impose. Then I can analytically compute how much flow happens in those boundary flows, which is what we do here. So these are solutions where we change, I think we just changed the diapigna diffusivity here. I'm going to do a whole bunch of solutions for different values of the bottom value of the diapigna diffusivity to show you whether the scaling works. But this is a solution. This is the upslope flow, and this is downslope flow, and this is normal to the boundary, just to show you that you can get the analytical solution for, given a stratification, what that slope would be. And I can compute down here how much transport along the slope I predict for that stratification and that slope. So if I take that, I get these magenta lines. I think I had to choose at what depth I stop the integral, whether I do it exactly where there is a zero crossing or I choose some fixed value, some fraction above the bottom boundary. It doesn't really matter all that much. So I just have an analytical solution. I have to decide what I call the upslope flow, how far up from the boundary I integrate. And you see that I get this number of curves of difference values of kappa. And I just show you that the larger kappa, the stronger the overturning, as you might expect. And these dots are numerical solution with this ball model of the maximum of the overturning. And what we can show is that just using the analytical solution of the boundary flow, I can predict what the full overturning is. That's very different from the Mank or Stommel view of the world, where it was an interior budget that sets the strength of that overturning. Here it tells you that the strength of that overturning is fully set by the strength of situation along bottom boundary layer. And it really scales with the kappa in those bottom boundary layer, not with the interior kappa. Yes?
So if you go to your previous slide, the up arrows along the bathymetry, that's bottom boundary layer, and therefore they're very hard to measure. But the ones that go down, they're in geostrophic balance and they should be observable. Is that correct?
Neither of the two is in geostrophic balance because I'm looking at the component that crosses density surfaces. So measuring them is not trivial, right?
But so how? So it is also. Oh, so it's not a. How does it cross? It's away from your bottom, and therefore...
So this is coming downward, right? So it was the solution I was showing before. Okay. What I'm showing is that there is some flow coming up.
Oh, it's also against the bottom, somehow.
Right, this is the part of the flow where the mixing, the profile W prime, B prime, is increasing with height. And this is where it's decreasing, right? So this is where the flow is going up, and this is where it comes down. So all of that circulation is within 500 meter, 1,000 meter of the bottom.
Okay. I get it. Sorry. Yes.
So you hit on an important point. None of them is trivial to measure directly. To make the problem worse, also for myself, you can think about what a water parcel really does in that flow, because I keep talking about the water mass transformation. But if I want to know what a water parcel would do in that boundary layer, right, these are my density surfaces. So I said that it's true that a water parcel is going to move up slope in the boundary layer, but what I'm never talking about in this particular model, because I don't have inertia, there are no instabilities that develop in that flow, so I don't have a long isopycnal flow. And if you're talking about density, that is not particularly relevant. But if you're talking about anything else, indeed, there will be very fast flows that exchange properly between the boundary layers and the interior. So your parcel try to go up, get detrained, then come back up, get detrained. So it will go up in a spiral kind of way. Right? It's just that the jumps upward are faster than the sink downward. And so in the net, you can talk about what is the net upwelling, which is an average between the two. But if looking at tracer, it's not going to be easy to single out one aspect versus the other, even though they are happening really in different places. So what about measuring it? And this is just advertising.
Before you leave that sort of I was going to ask you about this aspect where you do get intrusions in boundary layers and stratified flows, and I guess sort of answer that. But if you look at the e-folding depth of your diffusivity, how does that, if the e-folding depth is comparable or more than the total depth of the ocean?
Well, if it's more than the total depth of the ocean, you've taken away any relevant vertical gradient and you're back to Walter Mank. Okay. In that case, you would get diffusive upwelling everywhere through the water column because now the increase is not fast enough. So it's really a competition between the strength of the e-folding scale of the stratification versus the e-folding scale of your kappa. And the folding scale of your kappa should be faster than the folding scale of the stratification in the abyss, which it typically is, but if it wasn't, and you can definitely set up, and that's something we played with, you can set up calculation where that's not the case, and then the situation changes, and the boundary layer flow are not controlling the solution.
So maybe I missed something, but it seems like you're arguing that all the action's going on in these boundary layers.
Yeah.
But you motivated this by talking about observations of these flows, and those observations, I assume, were not made at the boundary layer, like in the boundary layers, right?
Absolutely. And this is comes back to this calculation, right? I mean, I contend that all the action is driven by what happens here, but I could measure the flow going north. This is a geostrophic flow, and the flow coming back, this is a geostrophic flow. So that's what I could measure, and that's the overturning that's being plotted.
Okay. And now, when you first plotted the overturning, there's these two cells, so there was some interesting structure kind of going on in the middle.
Okay, so I'm talking only about the lower cell. We can go back to that picture, but I'm trying to avoid. So I'm really trying to talk about what is happening within this cell here where there is topography that generates this mixing that is driving the circulation. As you move above the 2,000 meter, there is very little topography, so you enter in a new regime where it's less clear that diffusivity become weaker.
Right. And the things that's going on in the north is a separate problem.
This one here?
Yeah.
Well, the sinking is crucial, right? In both cases, I'm saying that this is happening through different process that sets the rate of transformations. In my case, I prescribe this to through this restoring to a background stratification. But yes, if you want to do the full problem, you would have to give me the dynamics that set that problem. I say, given that, and the reason I was claiming that I can prescribe is that this is a fast adjustment time scale compared to the interior. So I'm saying I can prescribe that and see how the rest adjust in response to that forcing. Then I can solve for the fast time scale too and supposedly find a more complete picture.
Two questions. Have you, in any of your papers on this, have you done sort of a DNS calculation like the one on the right where you've got inertia? Have you seen something like that?
This is... Baylor didn't comment on it, right? Because it's again the same problem that we did when he was at MIT. Now you see that there is a tilt to isothickness. As soon as you have a tilt to isothickness, that system is baroclinically unstable. It will undergo essentially the equivalent of what we call this mixed layer baroclinic instability by in the bottom. So yes, it becomes very active, and you do have these strong exchanges no matter what, because you start having a long isothickness flow through the baroclinic adjustment. And it's actually quite important because it turns out that if Larry Army, for people that know Larry Army, had a strong and corrosive exchange with Chris Garrett on those solutions. And I must admit that Chris Garrett definitely solved the problem correctly, but it turns out that it might be irrelevant for the real ocean, because if you try to take his solution and take a place like the Brazil Basin is a basin where they were profiling of turbulence all the way to the ocean bottom, essentially, and of stratification. So you have the full structure that you need to construct that solution. You find that Chris Garrett predicts if you take at face value the vertical profile of diffusivity that we're measuring that experiment, he would contend that the bottom of that ocean should be essentially unstratified. The reason why it is stratified is that you had to add baroclinic instability to that picture, and that what keeps it stratified. So those solutions are incomplete in that sense, in the sense that it's not a realizable solution because it's unstable on very fast time scales. But that makes it more complicated.
Makes sense. One other question on the larger scale, the overall theory. If you started from the biogeochemistry evidence, water mass in the large scale, what was wrong, and does this get it right, or do you know the answer to that yet? Is it the implied distributions of biogeochemical transfers? Say, I mean, for example, the upwelling, the stuff you get on the eastern side would go along with. Add to like Ekman upwelling for eastern boundary upwelling systems and things like this. Is there a significant change?
Yeah, but here you're talking below 2,000 meters. That's why I was trying to think like carbon is pretty homogeneous down there. Now, does it?
I mean, a lot of my base theory, but I guess, there was Togweiler and Samuels, which you don't mention, this idea that it was sort of in between Munk and Stammel's, the the abyssal recipes and what you're talking about, where this idea that you could get a lot of the ocean right by having a kind of adiabatic interior and just mixing along the surface, the upper surface.
So I would contend that no, they never quite said that. They said for the upper cell, you can.
Yeah.
Maybe, but this is all about the lower cell, the Pacific. You can't, I mean, that thing has somehow to cross in density surface.
If I look at the best current model estimates, the lower, the deep stratification is significantly wrong. And the implied large scale distribution of tracers is.
So, one thing that I know for a fact is that. Let's see. Let's start with the idealized version of the models, because if I go through the full model, it becomes a bit complicated to go into detail. But if I take these idealized models that we all love to run, which are big boxes, square boxes, with one, two basins, or whatever you want to do, in those kind of solutions, so now you have a flat bottom, if you get an exponential increase in kappa towards the ocean bottom, your system becomes unstratified. So you cannot get a sensible solution with stratification and a properly designed overturning consistently if you have bottom increased kappas. Now, when you're talking about, and that is because, again, the, you need to have the sloping boundaries. I mean, your kappa would trend to bring waters towards the ocean bottom. Now you have a flat bottom. The water can only slide horizontally. So what happens is that you start developing convective cells that unstratify the ocean, and that's the only solution you can get. Typically, in those idealized models, what we do, we use a constant kappa, so we avoid the full problem. So now those models will give you the right overturning and the right stratification, but the buoyancy flux you get has the opposite profile from what observation shows. So you never got quite the full picture right. When you start putting the whole complication of a three-dimensional model, it becomes a bit trickier, because probably there are places where you have serious biases and others not, but it's a bit less clear-cut for me how to prove what the issues might be. Even when you have the proper slopes, even when you have the proper profile of kappa, what I was contending, numerical models on large scale, in any case, don't resolve the boundary flows in the way they should. So I don't think that even the profile of kappa is going to fix the problem, because you get very spurious mixing along those boundaries. They are just too steep. I don't know what is done in the atmosphere. You have steep flows. There, since it matters for local prediction, people must have sorted out the problem better than we do, but maybe not on time scales, as long as the one we want to deal with. I wanted to show, it's just one slide, but just to say, yes, can you measure it? I don't think we measured it yet, or any of these processes, because, well, first of all, if you ever went on a ship with people using this vertical profiler, they cost $1 million a shot, and we know the bottom topography of the ocean reasonably well, but not the meter level or the 10-meter level everywhere. So the last thing they want to do is to slam their instrument in the mud. So they can avoid, so they always want to stop way above the boundary layer if they can.
You have disposable tips, which is the way
you could. Yeah, you could. It's not that you cannot. It's just that it's generally not done, because it's just easier to avoid the whole problem. People like Jim Ledwell and the microstructure group in Futsal were very careful, always tried to be way above any hill that they knew about. So you don't get generally profile all the way to the ocean bottom. The other part that makes the problem a bit tricky is that turbulence very close to the ocean bottom is in regions where the stratification becomes weak. So a lot of the arguments that are used to measure these profiles is to look at mixing events and see how much they change the stratification. But in weak stratification, those arguments start becoming a bit iffy. Or if you're on the mixing efficiency, it comes into play. So what we are suggesting is that you could do an experiment, and there is a proposal in ongoing, it's been reviewed. It's a joint UK-US proposal. The US has been approved, but now we're waiting for the UK. So if the UK goes along, we're fine. Otherwise, I don't know. But the idea is to go to the Rockall Trough. This is off the coast of Ireland. It's a nice bowl, so it looks a lot like the numerical model. So the first thing you want to do is to make sure the nature looks like your model. And it's really nice is that it's 2,000 meters deep, which is, means that it's deep enough not to be influenced by wind forcing, which is not part of the abyssal circulation story. but not 4,000 meters deep as the center of the Atlantic or the Pacific. So you save pretty much 60% of the time for every profile by just not having to go that deep. Now, the advantage is that you can put a number of moorings and now put ADCP, instrument to measure vertical velocity and temperature fluctuation, so you can measure the flux from direct correlation, because if you can anchor the instrument to the ground, it's something you can do. It's much harder to do it with a free-falling profiler. So if you can compute those correlations, now you can compute the flux instead of inferring it indirectly. So that's something we can do. We can also take vertical profiles to match where the water is still stratified and see that the two approaches are consistent. So we can definitely measure vertical profiles and mixing on the way to the ocean bottom. But on top of it, we can also inject dyes along the bottom, and we should be able to see the dye rising for a few days up the slope before it gets entrained in the interior. And then we're also going to have some tracer, the difference between a tracer and a dye. A dye is generally some fluorescent dye that decays pretty rapidly. A tracer can be measured at much lower concentration, but you cannot sample it as easily. So it's a much coarser sampling. So we're also going to have a tracer that instead we can use to see once the tracer has been mixed in and out of the boundary, the fact that it undergoes its looping profile. So in the net, it's moving up density, even though we see that it was rising, the dye was rising much faster along the slope itself, and we should be able to match the two.
Dye and tracer mean different things? I've never heard the distinction.
In the observational world, yes, because the dye is considered a fluorescent. I'm not saying that in the dictionary. They're supposed to mean different things, but I had to learn the hard way that this is the line. A dye is something that has a short lifetime, while a tracer is something you can measure for long times. At least, maybe I should be careful about saying physical oceanography, in Jim Ledwell's group. But there are many other groups, I mean, Martin Bischbeck probably, that do this kind of exercise. I'm done. The people that work on this problem, most of the theoretical work was with Jon Kallis, Alim Mashayek. I don't know that I show anything here that we've really done, but the first few papers were done with him when we're looking at the importance of boundary layers, and Henri Drake is the student working on the problem now.
So
we have, what, half an hour, and then it continues?
No, so we have 45 minutes, and so we're supposed to be back in this room for the Blackboard talk. Which should be shorter. Those are supposed to be hours. But anyway, I guess the part that confuses me about the planetary geostrophy version is momentum or the vorticity budget. Because with the Rayleigh drag, I mean, you're able to damp vorticity up in that downward return flow in a way that you're not in the. I mean, it's a peculiar west. I mean, it's not a deep western boundary current, it's a mid-depth western boundary current, right? I mean, I suspect it's probably something bumping along high and low topography in a more interesting way, if there was a real-world analog, that it's not the same structure, but that's a very weird momentum budget.
The reason I'm smiling, I think that you spend a lot of time with Joe Pedlowski. I think there is a bit of, in the theoretical literature, forgetting that the ocean always has a bottom. Right, it's true that, so these boundary currents definitely touch the bottom everywhere, because indeed the aspect ratio is such. So my guess is that I could put just simple linear friction and you still get a frictional boundary flow. They will just sitting on top of each other along the boundary, but they can still move back and forth. It's not conservative PV really.
So. No, but there would have to be a vertical exchange of the PV to make that.
Yeah.
That's the part that I don't understand is, that, and it probably is something to do with these little oscillation loops if you think about it more mechanistically. But that's a.
Yeah, but you keep injecting PV here, right? And then you can have a cut.
Yeah.
And those exchanges are pretty fast because they are fast.
But I mean, if those exchanges are super fast, then you've lost the shear, and now you're just not, you don't have an upward and a downward, you just have a net upward.
No, because it's like a mixed layer redness, right? You work. Oh, I mean, you always have a geostrophic shear, you don't completely mix it away, so it's always there. I mean, we didn't see cases where you suppress the instability.
Yeah, but you don't know what the boundary condition is on the momentum. That's the part. The bottom, what sets the bottom velocity is different from what sets the shear. And so that's the part that you get to play in. And so the deep western boundary currents, where they have actually measured them with current meters, always go the Stommel-Ahrens direction. So nobody's ever seen one going the other way. that's the part that's like, that's what I'm, that's, so I don't know. I mean, I think the observational campaign will sort it out or it won't. But it's not clear to me how you balance your other momentum of your momentum or vorticity equations in this system. If you really have to interact with not bottom drag but something like bottom pressure torque or something over bumps.
So first of all, I think that once you don't conserve PV, I find that PV arguments are not terribly useful, because what it tells you is that the system will be able to inject or extract PV as needed as you move. So I don't know how much it constrains. So you're absolutely right that momentum budget is different and you should solve for it. But I'm not so sure they provide a strong constraint to say what actually ought to happen or not happen.
No, it doesn't.
It might be able to
just
adjust.
That's exactly the point. I think there is no constraint on what has to happen, but there is a momentum vorticity problem
absolutely.
That is set up.
But I can't solve it in this framework.
You can't solve it in the system. So I don't know what it looks like.
The second point, I think it's actually something that I keep working around and I don't have an answer, which is it true that Western boundary currents are consistent with the Stommel-Aarons picture? And I'm not so sure that they are, in the sense that in the Pacific, there is a bit of a boundary flow that we see entering into the Pacific, but that seems pretty obvious. I mean, there is water that has to come in there. Any theory that tells you that there is an exchange will have a Western boundary current going in the right direction. This would do too. On top of it, it's not clear. I mean, it stops at some point. I think they find it 10, 15 degrees north of the Southern Ocean, but then it's not clear what happens beyond that. There aren't even detailed measurements, so I don't even know that we know exactly how that overturning through be closer in the Pacific.
And if you look at things like Rayfos flows or oxygen, you see eddy transport bigger than anything else, so it's probably an eddy process as much as anything else.
But I agree that it would be fun to start moving beyond the a simple LES 3D picture and start looking on the larger scale, but it's not trivial.
You mentioned Larry Army.
Yeah.
Larry Army and a very young Sarmiento took measurements of radon, etc., to infer vertical defeasibility, ignoring your complicated picture on the blackboard.
Yeah.
But if you go to those sorts of traces that are derived from ocean sediments, can you use those to infer or look at the consistency?
So you might. Indeed, as you said, part of the problem originally was it was interpreted, I think, in the wrong way. So, and Walter Mann came around and started explaining what the vertical profile of kappa and temperature really were, and they abandoned it. I asked Jorge Sarmiento whether we could look at the data, and he said at this point he doesn't know how he would even track them down. There must be other data set you couldn't. So that's one answer. What we looked a bit at is that there are instead delta C14 tracer measurements. That's another way. This is an age or something. The depletion of delta C14 tells you about something about how much that tracer has been in the water column. And Togweiler, talking to him, has tried to estimate delta C14 profiles pretty deep in the water column. You do have a tendency to see very depleted delta C14 waters along the margins. And by very depleted, it would imply hundreds of years old waters that can't be just wind-driven profiles. So maybe you are seeing some deep water seeping through the surface. However, the interpretation of those data apparently is very sketchy because you have radio bomb signals, I mean, nuclear explosion signals. And whether you can really do it's a bit unclear. So we haven't pursued it all that much, but there might be tracer available, or helium would be another one that one could use and get more direct connection with real data. But putting a dye is much more fun.
Well, can you think of a scenario in which the Gulf Stream would change direction?
Sure, if you change the rotation rate of the Earth, the sense of the westerlies, but otherwise, no. Just not going to, not the direction. That is wind driven, and that part is very hard. For this abyssal situation, I would contend that you can if you change the topography. So if you're talking about very deep climates, then that's something that might become interesting, but it's probably a speculation because you know so little generally when you go far enough that you change the topography, then whether the bottom boundary current change direction is not going to be a leading order control on the solution.
Thanks, Ron.